This is Lynn, and I'll be reading today from the New York Times for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. And the first article is, Will a Mountain of Evidence Be Enough to Convict Trump? Monday, we'll see opening statements in the People of the State of New York versus Donald Trump. The state's case seems strong, but a conviction is far from assured. By Ben Protes and Jonah Bromwich. In the official record, the case is known as the People of the State of New York versus Donald J. Trump. And for now, the people have the stronger hand. They have insider witnesses, a favorable jury pool, and a lurid set of facts about a presidential candidate, a payoff, and a porn star. On Monday, the prosecutors will formally introduce the case to 12 all-important jurors, embarking on the first prosecution of an American president. The trial, which could brand Mr. Trump a felon as he mounts another White House run, will reverberate throughout the nation and test the durability of the justice system that Mr. Trump is attacking in a way that no other defendant would be allowed to do. Though the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, has assembled a mountain of evidence, a conviction is hardly assured. Over the next 6 weeks, Mr. Trump's lawyers will seize on three apparent weak points: a key witness's credibility, a president's culpability, and the case's legal complexity. Prosecutors will seek to maneuver around those vulnerabilities, dazzling the jury with a tale that mixes politics and sex as they confront a shrewd defendant with a decades-long track record of skirting legal consequences. They will also seek to bolster the credibility of that key witness, Michael Cohen, a former fixer to Mr. Trump, who previously pleaded guilty to federal crimes for paying the porn star Stormy Daniels. Daniel Horowitz, a veteran defense lawyer who previously worked in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office prosecuting white-collar cases, said prosecutors can be expected to corroborate Mr. Cohen's story wherever possible. The prosecution has layers upon layers of evidence to back up what Michael Cohen says, Mr. Horowitz said. Both sides will lay out their cases in opening statements on Monday, offering dueling interpretations of the evidence some 6 years after the payoff to Ms. Daniels entered the public consciousness and briefly imperiled Mr. Trump's presidency. But in previewing the case for prospective jurors last week, Manhattan prosecutors emphasized neither the payoff that secured Ms. Daniels' silence nor the sex scandal that was buried in the process. One prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, instead distilled the trial's stakes to a fundamental question. This is a case about the rule of law and whether or not Donald Trump broke it. Mr. Steinglass's boss, Mr. Bragg, has offered a loftier interpretation, casting Mr. Trump's actions as election interference. Although Mr. Trump's lawyers might claim he was merely trying to hide embarrassing stories from his family, Mr. Bragg says Mr. Trump orchestrated a scheme to conceal simmering sex scandals from voters as they headed to the polls in 2016. All told, his allies struck three hush money deals, paying off people who had stories to tell, stories that could have derailed Mr. Trump's candidacy. Mr. Bragg's prosecutors will seek to turn that 2016 campaign strategy against him. The tactics that helped propel Mr. Trump to victory will be admitted as evidence and reconsidered far beyond the courtroom. Aides and friends who lied on Mr. Trump's behalf will take the witness stand to testify against him. They include David Pecker, the tabloid publisher who bought and buried damaging stories about Mr. Trump, Hope Hicks, a spokeswoman who tried to spin reporters, and Mr. Cohen, the fixer who paid Ms. Daniels. Mr. Pecker, who ran the company that owned the National Enquirer, is set to go first and is expected to recount for the jury several conversations with Mr. Trump about the hush money, according to a person familiar with the plan. Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts and up to 4 years behind bars, but more than just his freedom is at stake. If convicted, he might lose the right to vote, including to cast a ballot for himself. If he were to win back the White House, he would be the first convicted criminal to serve as commander-in-chief. And the question of how he might serve a prison sentence, should it come to that if he does not receive probation, could throw the country into turmoil. America has grown accustomed to seeing Mr. Trump smash through its customs and is now witnessing a phenomenon that is a first in the 248 years of its history. Presidents have been impeached, driven from office, and rejected at the polls. Mr. Trump is about to be the first to have his fate decided not just by voters, but by 12 citizens in a jury box. And they all hail from Manhattan, the borough that made Mr. Trump famous and where he is now deeply unpopular. Favorable jury pool, legal experts say, has given Mr. Bragg a leg up at the trial. Yet the jury, which was made final on Friday and includes six alternates, is no rubber stamp. It includes at least two people who have expressed some affection for the former president, and it takes only one skeptical member to force a mistrial, an outcome that Mr. Trump would celebrate as a win. The stakes are high for Mr. Bragg as well. He is betting his career and his legacy on a prosecution he inherited, rejected, and then transformed. When he took office in 2022, he declined to bring a financial fraud case against Mr. Trump that his predecessor had prepared, prompting an uproar when two prosecutors resigned in protest. But Mr. Bragg continued to investigate and soon revisited the hush money deal, an episode that had become known internally as the zombie case because it kept coming back to life. Little more than a year after taking office, Mr. Bragg indicted the former president. Three other indictments followed in three other cities, but with those cases mired in delay, Mr. Bragg's trial may now be the only one that Mr. Trump will face before Election Day. The Manhattan case comprises the three hush money deals with Ms. Daniels, with a former Playboy model, and with a one-time doorman who told of a tale of Mr. Trump fathering a child out of wedlock. Mr. Pecker and his tabloid bought the silence of the doorman, whose story turned out to be false. They also bought the rights to the story by the model, Karen McDougal, and then never wrote it, a practice known as catch and kill. Then there was Miss Daniels, who was interested in selling her story of a sexual encounter with Mr. Trump. Mr. Pecker drew the line there. Her price was too high. Instead, he and a top editor alerted Mr. Cohen, who soon paid Miss Daniels $130,000 not to tell her story about a sexual encounter with Mr. Trump a decade earlier. Mr. Cohen has said he acted at Mr. Trump's direction, but the former president is not charged over the payment itself. Instead, he stands accused of covering up the transaction by disguising reimbursements to Mr. Cohen. In internal records, Mr. Trump's company marked those payments as legal expenses, citing a retainer agreement. Yet no such expenses existed, prosecutors say, and the retainer agreement was fictional. Mr. Trump is accused of engineering or at least approving the cover-up. His company, prosecutors argue, produced 34 false records that underpin the counts against him, 11 checks, 11 monthly invoices Mr. Cohen submitted, and 12 entries in the general ledger for Mr. Trump's trust. Mr. Trump signed several of the checks in the White House, as prosecutors will surely point out at the trial. But directly linking Mr. Trump to the plot to falsify those records is another matter altogether. His lawyers will be likely to argue that he was oblivious and that Mr. Cohen handled the specifics. Mr. Cohen hashed out the reimbursement plan with Mr. Trump's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, who is serving jail time for perjury and will not testify, records show. The lack of a first-hand witness to confirm Mr. Cohen's account is a potential flaw in the case, but it may not be fatal. Prosecutors plan to introduce a document containing Mr. Weisselberg's handwritten notes about the reimbursements, a key piece of evidence demonstrating that Mr. Cohen did not act alone. And under the law, the prosecutors need not prove that Mr. Trump personally falsified the records. Already during the trial's first week, Mr. Steinglass laid the groundwork with a simple analogy. He asked prospective jurors whether they could accept that if a husband hired a hitman to murder his wife, the husband was just as guilty as the man who pulled the trigger. Can you all follow the same kind of logic in this case? Mr. Steinglass asked the prospective jurors. Many said they could. Mr. Cohen is expected to offer the closest thing this case has to a smoking gun. He is likely to say that in early 2017, he and Mr. Trump discussed the repayment scheme in the Oval Office. If Mr. Trump testifies in his own defense, that could pit Mr. Cohen's word against Mr. Trump's. A he-said-he-said story with two questionable narrators. Whether or not Mr. Trump takes the stand, the trial could become a referendum on Mr. Cohen's credibility, with the verdict possibly hinging on a convincing performance. In 2018, Mr. Cohen pleaded guilty to a variety of federal crimes, admitting to participating in the hush money deals with Ms. Daniels and Ms. McDougal and lying to Congress about plans for a Trump business deal in Russia. Mr. Trump's lawyers will seek to emphasize Mr. Cohen's checkered past at every turn. And on cross-examination, Mr. Trump's lawyers are likely to portray Mr. Cohen as a serial liar with a grudge against his former boss. Susan Nichols, one of Mr. Trump's lawyers, began that campaign during jury selection. She referenced Mr. Cohen's 2022 book, Revenge, questioning the credibility of someone who says that they want revenge against Mr. Trump, President Trump. Yet the prosecution is expected to note that Mr. Cohen told many of his lies for Mr. Trump, and prosecutors will offer evidence corroborating the broad strokes of Mr. Cohen's story, which could persuade jurors when they are weighing his testimony about the crucial Oval Office meeting. Mr. Trump's White House executive assistant, Madeleine Westerhout, who has been identified as a potential witness, could confirm that Mr. Cohen did indeed meet with Mr. Trump, even if she cannot confirm what they discussed. Mr. Pecker can support at least some of Mr. Cohen's testimony about Mr. Trump's involvement in the hush money deals, and a recording Mr. Cohen made of a call he had with Mr. Trump will capture the former president discussing the deal with Ms. McDougal. The prosecution's argument is that you can trust Michael Cohen beyond a reasonable doubt as to their isolated conversation, said Mr. Horowitz, the former prosecutor. He called the approach Prosecuting 101. And the next article is Trump's trial challenge being stripped of control. The mundanity of the courtroom has all but swallowed Donald Trump, who for decades has sought to project an image of bigness and a sense of power. By Maggie Haberman. Sir, can you please have a seat? Donald J. Trump had stood up to leave the Manhattan criminal courtroom as Justice Juan Merchan was wrapping up a scheduling discussion on Tuesday. But the judge had not yet adjourned the court or left the bench. Mr. Trump, the 45th president of the United States and the owner of his own company, is used to setting his own pace. Still, when Justice Merchan admonished him to sit back down, the former president... did so without saying a word. The moment underscored a central reality for the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. For the next 6 weeks, a man who values control and tries to shape environments and outcomes to his will is in control of very little. Everything about the circumstances in which the former president comes to court every day to sit as the defendant in the People versus Donald J. Trump at 100 Center Street is repellent to him. The trapped-in-amber surroundings that evoke New York City's more crime-ridden past. The lack of control. The details of a case in which he is accused of falsifying business records to conceal a payoff to a porn star to keep her claims of an affair with him from emerging in the 2016 election. Of the four criminal cases Mr. Trump is facing, this is the one that is the most acutely personal, and people close to him are blunt when privately discussing his reaction. He looks around each day and cannot believe he has to be there. Asked about the former president's aversion to the case, a campaign spokeswoman, Caroline Leavitt, said that Mr. Trump proved he will remain defiant and call the case political lawfare. He is sitting in a decrepit courtroom that, for the second half of last week, was so cold his lead lawyer complained respectively to the judge about it. Mr. Trump hugged his arms to his chest and told an aide, "It's freezing." For the first few minutes of each day during jury selection, a small pool of still photographers was ushered into Part 59 on the 15th floor of the courthouse. Mr. Trump, obsessed with being seen as strong and being seen generally, prepared for them to rush in front of him by adjusting his suit jacket and contorting his face into a jut-jawed scowl. But by day's end on Friday, Mr. Trump appeared haggard and rumpled, his gait off center, his eyes blank. Mr. Trump has often seemed to fade into the background in a light wood-paneled room with harsh fluorescent lighting and a perpetual smell of sour, coffee-laced breath wafting throughout. His face has been visible to dozens of reporters watching in an overflow room on a large monitor with a closed-circuit camera trained on the defense table. He has whispered to his lawyer and poked him to get his attention, leafed through sheafs of paper, and at least twice appeared to nod off during the morning session. His aides have publicly denied he was dozing. Nodding off is something that happens from time to time to various people in court proceedings, including jurors, but it conveys, for Mr. Trump, the kind of public vulnerability he has rigorously tried to avoid. Trials are by nature mundane, with strict routines and long periods of inactivity. Mr. Trump has always steered clear of this type of officialism, whether by eschewing strict schedules or anyone else's practices or structures, from the time he was in his 20s through his time in the Oval Office. The mundanity of the courtroom has all but swallowed Mr. Trump, who for decades has sought to project an image of bigness, one he rode from a reality television studio set to the White House. When the first panel of 96 prospective jurors was brought into the room last Monday afternoon, Mr. Trump seemed to disappear among them as they were seated in the jury box and throughout the rows in the well of the court. The judge has made clear that the juror's time is his highest priority, even when it comes at the former president's expense. Mr. Trump's communications advisors or aides who provide him with a morale boost have been sitting at a remove. Natalie Harp, a former host on the right-wing OAN News Network, who for years has carried a portable printer to supply Mr. Trump with a steady stream of uplifting articles or social media posts about him, is there. But she and others have been in the second row behind the defense table or several rows back in the courtroom, unable to talk to Mr. Trump during the proceedings. It is hard to recall any other time when Mr. Trump has had to sit and listen to insults without turning to social media or a news conference to punch back, and it is just as hard to recall any other time he has been forced to be bored for so long. People close to him are anxious about how he will handle having so little to do as he sits there for weeks on end, with only a handful of days of testimony expected to be significant. It has been decades since he has had to spend so much time in the immediate vicinity of anyone who is not part of his family, his staff, or his throng of admirers. Over the next 6 weeks or so, Mr. Trump will have to endure more, including listening as prosecutors ask witnesses uncomfortable questions about his personal life in open court. On Tuesday, he'll face a hearing over whether the judge agrees with prosecutors that he has repeatedly violated the order prohibiting him from publicly criticizing witnesses and others. Most of the time, Mr. Trump has been forced to sit at the table, unable to use his cell phone, and listen as prosecutors have described him as a criminal, as jurors have been asked their opinions of him. Some of those opinions have been negative, with one potential juror made to read aloud her old social media posts blasting him as a sociopath and an egomaniac. The only times he has smiled have been when prospective jurors have referred to work of his that they have liked. The highly telegraphed plan was for Mr. Trump to behave as a candidate in spite of the trial, using the entire event as a set piece in his claims of a weaponized judicial system. But last week in New York, Mr. Trump's only political event was a stop at an Upper Manhattan bodega to emphasize crime rates in the borough. The appearance seemed to breathe life into him, but it also felt more like a stop a mayoral candidate would make than a presumptive presidential nominee. Some advisors are conscious of Mr. Trump appearing diminished and are pressing for more and larger events around the New York area. Many in Mr. Trump's broader orbit are pessimistic about the case ending in a hung jury or a mistrial, and they see an outright acquittal as virtually impossible. They are bracing for him to be convicted, not because they see the legal grounds, but because they think jurors in overwhelmingly Democratic Manhattan will be against the polarizing former president. But the shared sense among many of his advisors is that the process may damage him as much as a guilty verdict. The process, they believe, is its own punishment. Next, how Mike Johnson got to yes on aid to Ukraine. Intelligence, politics, and personal considerations converted the Republican speaker, who had largely opposed aid to Ukraine as a rank-and-file member, into the key figure pushing it through Congress. By Katie Edmondson. For weeks, the Senate passed a sprawling aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Speaker Mike Johnson agonized over whether and how the House would take up funding legislation that would almost certainly infuriate the right wing of his party and could cost him his job. He huddled with top national security officials, including William Burns, the CIA director, in the Oval Office to discuss classified intelligence. He met repeatedly with broad factions of Republicans in both swing and deep red districts and considered their voters' attitudes toward funding Ukraine. He thought about his son, who is set to attend the U.S. Naval Academy in the fall. And finally, when his plan to work with the Democrats to clear the way for aiding Ukraine met with an outpouring of venom from ultra-conservatives already threatening to depose him, Mr. Johnson, an evangelical Christian, knelt and prayed for guidance. "I want to be on the right side of history," Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, recalled the speaker telling him. Mr. Johnson's decision to risk his speakership to push the $95 billion foreign aid bill through the House on Saturday was the culmination of a remarkable personal and political arc for the Louisiana Republican. It was also an improbable outcome for a man plucked from relative obscurity last fall by the hard right, which had just deposed a speaker they deemed a traitor to their agenda, to be the speaker of a deeply dysfunctional House. As a rank-and-file hardliner, Mr. Johnson had largely opposed efforts to fund Kyiv's war effort. And early in his speakership, he declared he would never allow the matter to come to a vote until his party's border demands were met. But by the time he made clear he planned to band together with Democrats to muscle through the aid package over the objections of many in his party, Mr. Johnson was speaking a starkly different language. "History judges us for what we do," he told reporters at the Capitol last week. "This is a critical time right now. I could make a selfish decision and do something that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important." Mr. Johnson attributed his turnabout in part to the intelligence briefings he received, a striking assertion from a leader of a party that has embraced former President Donald J. Trump's deep mistrust of the intelligence community. "I really do believe the intel," Mr. Johnson said. "I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Baltics next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies." Mr. McCaul, who repeatedly huddled with Mr. Johnson and the chairman of the other congressional national security committees in a secure room of the Capitol where lawmakers can review classified material, described Mr. Johnson's journey as transformational. All of a sudden, he's realizing that the world depends on this, Mr. McCall said. This is not some little political game on the floor. One of the most impactful briefings, according to people familiar with the discussions, came in February in the Oval Office when congressional leaders met with Mr. Biden to discuss government funding and aid for Ukraine. At that meeting, Mr. Burns and other top national security officials sought to impress upon Mr. Johnson how rapidly Ukraine was running out of ammunition and how dire the consequences would be if their air defenses were no longer reinforced by American weaponry. Convinced that they would come around to his way of thinking, Mr. Johnson repeatedly urged Republicans who opposed the funding measure to go to the secure space at the Capitol and receive the same intelligence briefings, according to people he spoke to. Mr. Johnson also was struck by the stories he heard in meetings with President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine and others about the magnitude of the misery Russian forces have unleashed across the embattled nation. All of it tugged at Mr. Johnson's sense of Christian faith. The speaker also faced mounting political pressure to act. Senate Democrats had struck a deal with Republicans to pair the aid to Ukraine with strict border measures, as the GOP had demanded. But after Mr. Trump denounced it, Republicans rejected it out of hand. Then the Senate passed its own $95 billion emergency aid legislation for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan without any immigration measures, and the onus was on the House to do the same. Adding to Mr. Johnson's predicament, he found himself badly out of step with the three other congressional leaders, most notably Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, who vocally supported bolstering Kyiv and saw it as a critical part of his legacy. That was evident at the White House meeting in February, which Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the majority leader described as an intense pile-on. Everyone in that room was telling Speaker Johnson how vital sending aid was, he said then. Privately, Mr. Johnson was huddling with his allies and puzzling over what measures they could include in a national security package to make it more palatable to Republicans. At retreats in Florida in February and West Virginia in March, he was already in discussions with Representative French Hill, Republican of Arkansas, about the Repo Act, which would pay for some of the aid by selling off Russian sovereign assets that had been frozen. That provision, which he described as pure poetry, later became a key part of Mr. Johnson's effort to sell his conference on the aid bill. Around the same time, Mr. Johnson began, first privately, then loudly, telling allies that he would ensure the U.S. would send funding to Kyiv. I think he always understood the importance of this and believes in the importance of this, Representative Mike Lawler, Republican of New York, said. The function of being speaker is to try to build consensus, and I think he wanted to find consensus among the conference. Unfortunately, there are some folks that are just unwilling to compromise. This has been Lynn reading from The Times. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great day and a wonderful week. Take care.